I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight.
We are here to make Starbucks a place where everyone feels welcome.
That's Starbucks CEO Kevin Johnson in a video promoting its company-wide racial bias training for employees. That training, happening today at Starbucks stores across the country, follows the arrests of two black men last month at a Philadelphia location. A white store manager called the police after the men refused to leave when they were told the restroom was for paying customers only. The viral incident set off immediate calls for reform at Starbucks, and while some see the trainings as a positive step forward, others view them as a publicity stunt. The trainings themselves were closed to the press, and company officials have not commented today. Here with some outside perspective is Tonya Ladipo, founder of the Ladipo Group. It's a counseling and consulting company in Philadelphia focusing on the African-American community. Tonya, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You do individual therapy, but apparently increasingly working with companies as well.
Yes, that's correct. About 2010, we expanded to work with companies and organizations because we realized that we spend a lot of time at work. And work isn't always the most comfortable place for everybody. And so we really wanted to broaden our horizons and do training and programming for companies on how to make a truly inclusive environment for everybody.
And so what are the tenets for making a truly inclusive environment?
It really starts from the top of an organization saying that not only am I going to give lip service to saying that this is a commitment, but we're actually going to put resources and, most importantly, policies behind it. So then it needs to filter in throughout HR, through hiring practices, through retention practices, onboarding practices, and really holding people accountable for their behavior. I always say you cannot tell somebody how to think, how to feel, or what their values are, but you can encourage and you can regulate behavior, especially when it's in the workplace.
So this isn't an attempt to change people's minds and their own biases and stereotypes.
I don't think it is if you're trying to do it well. And I have to say, my thinking about it has evolved over the years. You know, before it really was about values and you know, this is the right thing to do. You know, I have a very socially justice-oriented mindset. But the more I did it that way, the more I realized we were getting some pushback. And it wasn't necessarily effective. Not everybody needs to believe what I believe or think what I think. But we do need to have workplaces where everybody has the same economic opportunities for growth, for advancement. And so you don't have to think like I do for that.
Let's talk more about that top-down hierarchy you're suggesting in the context of a comment from a recent Starbucks employee who said that, in his estimation, Starbucks was essentially passing the buck onto its employees and that it instead should be, in this case, focusing on alternatives to calling the police. Can you weigh in on that perspective?
Sure. I think, you know, like we were talking about the top-down perspective, that there has to be things in place from a company that Starbucks says, this is our policy, this is how we handle things. And when you go outside of that, when your behavior becomes discriminatory, right, calling the police on two African-American men sitting there, but you didn't do it for other people, when the behavior is discriminatory, then the company steps in and says, this is unacceptable to us, you can no longer work here, which not only sends a message to that one employee, but it sends a message to all of the employees at Starbucks that this behavior isn't acceptable or tolerated. And these are the steps that you take when you're faced in this situation.
And so social media can act as a way to enforce that kind of accountability.
Definitely. I mean, Starbucks, what happened at Starbucks would not have gotten this far had it not been not just videotaped, but had it not been videotaped and then released widespread, right? Because somebody could have videotaped it and said, this was awful, and then deleted it. But because it was, you know, shared so many times, and then it was picked up by traditional media, then all of a sudden, it became an issue that could not be ignored.
Whether it's a police shooting of an unarmed black person, or gun violence in schools, or any of the hot button issues, we perhaps simplistically like to think that, aha, this is a watershed moment.
Yes.
Is the Starbucks training today a potential watershed moment?
I think that really lies with Starbucks, just like you said, with other circumstances. Oh, this is going to be the moment where things are different. And then we see months later that they're not. But because of the company Starbucks is, they are known for doing good in the community. They're, you know, they have a reputation of being a good company. And so they are in such a unique space right now. They have the opportunity to be the corporation that says we are going to do it differently. We're going to apologize, which we did, but we are going to truly make this change go forward throughout our company, not just today in a moment in time. So I really think it could be a watershed moment if Starbucks decides we are going to be the leader and we are going to stumble, we are going to make mistakes, but we're going to get through it and show other companies how to do it too.
Tanya LaDipa, thank you so much for helping us consider the next steps after today's action as well.
Thank you for asking. I appreciate the time.
Tanya LaDipa, founder of the LaDipa Group. It's a counseling and consulting company in Philadelphia focusing on the African-American community. Amalgam Comics and Coffee House in the East Kensington section of Philadelphia today hosted other area African-American coffee shop owners in a public discussion about the importance of supporting local black businesses. Joining me with more is Daryl C. Murphy. He was on hand there for WHYY and joins me now. Daryl, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Was this specifically organized in response to or in addition to the much more publicized Starbucks trainings today?
I'm not sure, but when I spoke to Mr. Kibakante, he said that I guess it was a chance for them to share their platform that they had and highlight these black businesses around the country.
Kibakante was the organizer of the event. I believe he's the founder of Red Bay Coffee. It's an online retail and wholesaler.
Yes, they sell wholesale online, and they also have shops in Oakland. And their business model is they employ is completely ran by black women, and you know they're very careful where they get their beans from and everything like that. And they kind of like develop this network across the country amongst small local coffee shops and different places.
And what was the thrust of what they were trying to convey to those in attendance?
Basically, just support your local businesses, local black businesses, and just be mindful that you get a little more there. Sometimes you don't get the deals. The prices aren't always the cheapest, but you're getting quality, you're getting atmosphere, and you're in a place where, you know, you have a little bit more freedom. It's more welcoming to you, you know. Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's in Germantown, he said that, you know, instead of boycotting, just make it a point to go support your local shops.
Sometimes it's about not having a protest strategy, but having a reinvestment strategy, right? Because to me, the most beautiful thing thing that happened after Starbucks wasn't people saying boycott Starbucks. It was saying, we ain't got to boycott Starbucks. Just go to Amalgam.
Yeah.
Amalgam was here before the Starbucks controversy, right? So you can walk in Amalgam and they won't call the police on you.
Yeah.
You can be around black folk. You can have that black joy that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Daryl, amplifying that sentiment was Shop Black founder Chantrell Lewis, who published an extensive list of dozens of black-owned coffee shops throughout the country.
Yes. It was like 47 black-owned coffee shops across the country that she had published. There's a lot more than that. But yeah, she published them and also mentioned how a lot of shops saw an increase in business as a result of it.
Was it a temporary spike or is it sustained better business?
I'm not sure. Okay. But one thing that was interesting was you know, she said the point of the list was just to kind of get people in the mindset of just already being proactive in supporting these local businesses and not waiting until something bad occurs to someone else.
Describe the scene this morning at Amalgam. In addition to the featured guests, was there a pretty big public response?
It was a decent crowd. There was a lot of press there.
Obviously, in response to Starbucks, it's understandable that we are talking now about coffee shops, but is the intent of the movement to expand beyond that form of retail and support other black merchants and other businesses?
Yeah, because like I said, the whole point is to already be in that mindset before a negative thing happens in a Starbucks or something like that. So like when it does happen, you know, it's not like, oh, let me go support these businesses now and make it like some sort of novelty or something. It's just like, okay, this happened over here. Well, that's just another reason why I already support my local business, you know?
Is there an easy way for consumers, customers, coffee lovers to find a list of businesses that they might choose to support?
I believe the list that Black Shop put up is on their website, shopblack.us. That's S-H-O-P-P-E blackblack.us.
How's the latte?
It's pretty good.
Thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much.
Darryl C. Murphy, he reports for WHYY. The solar industry is a relatively new player to Pennsylvania's energy landscape, and during its infancy, making a career in it was a bit of a gamble. But Hal Saville decided to give it a go.
It was something that I had to convince my family was the right thing to do, because I had a pretty cushy job and could have retired from doing that. And it was, you know, it was, the industry was somewhat slow to get on its feet and really gain momentum.
Saville works as a commercial energy project consultant for Energy Independent Solutions, developing and selling solar panel systems. For State Impact Pennsylvania's Voices of Energy series, Saville shares his story as a crew finishes installing the system's wiring.
How's it going? Are we able to come up and join you guys up there?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. This is where the rubber meets the road.
I've actually been interested in solar for over 30 years. And back in the mid-80s, went to school at Penn State for solar and architectural engineering. But there was really no solar market at the time. So I had a totally different career path. Sort of got to the point where I could quit my job in IT and work for a solar company, you know, that was just getting started. I definitely was nervous, and it was a big leap of faith. I'll go out and I'll meet with the clients early on, discuss what their needs are, and kind of understand what they would be interested in, and that allows me to make a recommendation. And then based on that recommendation, if they decide to go forward with it, we put together a formal proposal. So for this building, for example, we started out with this drawing that came from the architect that showed the area on the roof that they wanted to utilize for solar. But then also on the inside, you have to fit where the different mechanicals are in the building and make sure that everything fits.
We have another pipe dropping.
So are you coming through that space where all the other mechanicals are?
I do not. So we already blown our main line.
Coolest part of my job is getting a call from somebody saying, I'm ready to go. And sometimes that happens relatively quickly. I mean, I meet somebody who's like, they've been thinking about this for a long time, and they finally decided to check it out, and they've talked to us, and maybe they've talked to some other companies, and they've selected us, and they said, we're ready to go. And then I have other people. I just signed a contract this past week with somebody that I've been talking with for 4 years. And I met at one of these home show events, and we've kept in touch, and you know, they weren't ready, and there were other things going on in their lives, and then eventually they got to the point that they said, yes, you know, now we're going to go and do this. I try to keep things on a politically neutral basis and focus on the environmental benefits, but also on the financial benefits. And frankly, those two things are similar. I mean, when you talk about somebody being conservative and talk about conservation, they're from the same root word of to conserve. So I'm kind of all about trying to find that middle sensibility.
That was Hal Saville. His story was produced by Amy Sisk for State Impact Pennsylvania. It's a collaboration between WHYY, WITF, WESA, and the Allegheny Front, covering the Commonwealth energy economy. To hear more voices of energy, visit State Impact Pennsylvania online. The banks of the Delaware River in Bucks County are peppered with villages jammed between the Delaware Canal's edge and the hills. One of them, Lumberville, is a collection of old homes, an historic tavern, and a few stores. Photographer Bruce Katziff moved to Lumberville with his family in the late 1960s and now has published a book of photographs of the townspeople from that time. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna visited to see how much is the same decades later.
Rivertown Portraits is a sort of visual love poem to Lumberville and the people he lived with there for almost 40 years. The book opens with a photo of Katziff and his pregnant wife, Joanne, carrying big bags and toys for their young son. The photo conveys the feeling of a hippie refugee family. They were moving from Philadelphia to a new town with a population of about 160 people. It was already a place where artists mixed with mechanics, builders, and musicians, says Judy Siegfried-Glasso.
Early 70s when we first moved there, and it was the time of revolution and free thinking, free speech, free love. So
Siegfried-Glasso posed in the book with her then husband. In one photo, they're both naked. In another, clothed.
I don't remember how the picture came about. So we were, I think, a little stoned. And it just came about. The kids, if you notice in the picture, the kids were in the other room playing.
Most of the people in the photos, who are still alive, of course, have remained in the area. They all seem to hold fond memories of the early years. Lumberville has not changed much, Katziff says, mainly because there is no space to grow between the river and the hills.
In Lumberville, I believe there is not one house built this century in the town. So most of the properties are, 19th century properties. There's no development. There's no high rises. There are no sewers. And actually, it's the lack of sewers and the lack of public water that tends to restrict development in a significant way. And also, the river towns are in the floodplain.
Joanne Katziff loves the river and how it was the center of the community during all seasons.
The river was our life. Watching the river flow in the summer, watching the people boating, swimming, dogs carrying on. And then in the winter, when it would ice over sometimes, it was rare. And we went ice skating on the river.
And when I got there, I thought I was in heaven. I had never lived along a river. In those days, the canal was full. It was very lush. It was just beautiful.
Carla Van Dyke moved from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to Lumberville in the early 70s and opened a small bookstore next to the Black Bass Inn. She's portrayed in the book looking outside from a window, resting in a bed next to her big cat. She's still fascinated by the early history of the area when it was an industrial transportation hub.
Along the Delaware River, the canal, Delaware Canal, were a series of locks. So there was a lock there, and then the barges were carrying lumber and coal or whatever, I guess from Philly and then up into Pennsylvania where it connected with the Lehigh Canal. The Black Bass was a tavern, was an important stop on the way. And then the Tinsman Lumber Yard started very early, the oldest lumber yard in the country, and it's still there. And then, of course, there was a bridge that connected with New Jersey and Bull's Island. And then later on, a railroad paralleled the river on the Jersey side. There was a train stop there, which brought people down from New York or Philly. They could cross the bridge into Lumberville.
The tourists arrive later to the area and still walk the small bridge to New Jersey. For the residents capturing Bruce Katziff's photos, what was important was the quiet pace of the village. One more memory. All seem to remember the General Store, the heart of Lumberville.
The General Store was the center of town because it was also the post office. So everyone would stop at the General Store to pick up your mail. It was great because the owner was a wonderfully gracious fella. Actually, the cover of the book is a picture of Gerald Gordon, who grew up in Brooklyn and was a mailman and decided to leave the city and come and run the General Store. It's one of the oldest continuously operating general stores in America, and it was clearly the sense of community.
Today, the General Store is a cafe. The Black Bass Hotel is still there, and a small bookstore put the old post office sign just as a decoration to amuse the tourists. Bruce Katziff's book is a reminder of how much and how little time has changed the village and the people of Lumberville. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, ask any true Eagles fan, never write off the Birds. That was a lesson learned for new bride Jennifer Sullivan. She says in January, she was so certain the Eagles would lose the Super Bowl that she told fiancé Patrick Hanks he could wear a jersey to their wedding if the team won. Well, we all know how that turned out. So when wedding guests cheered the couple this past weekend in the Poconos, the excitement wasn't just about the union. Just before saying, "I do," the groom stripped off his tux jacket, grabbed a Carson Wentz jersey from the bushes behind him and put it on, causing guests to break out into a celebratory Eagles chant. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Dairy farming is a major part of Pennsylvania's economy. The Keystone State ranks 6th in the nation for milk production. But the industry is saturated with competition, and the state is losing dairy farms every year. Tomorrow evening, we'll look at what it means to be a family dairy farmer in Pennsylvania today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.